You're listening to On the Couch with Dr. Michelle, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Hey, thank you for being on the couch with me today. I'm Dr. Michelle Cohen, and we are going to have a fabulous show. I have an amazing guest, and he's written a book that has just blown me away. We were just talking about it before we went live. I'm still getting through it, but it's something so worth getting and reading to help you understand a little bit more about your emotions and why and how many variable emotions we all have. You know, when I'm working in therapy in my office with individuals and couples, they're kind of sitting across from me on the couch, you know, one of the most common issues that I hear or that comes up is that they're struggling to share how they feel or put a name to the emotion. You know, they just kind of don't understand their emotional reactions as well. They don't get it. And they're sometimes spontaneously, you know, like acting out or yelling, or they're angry or they're crying, or they're just saying, why am I doing that? Well, you know, it seems that for centuries, people have debated and measured and tried to regulate about their emotions. But really, no single work has attempted to really define the full landscape of everyday emotional states across disciplines. I mean, I've read so many books. That's what I had to do with my training, my education. But up until now, we're going to talk about The Biggie. It's an amazing book, authored by my brilliant guest, D. Earl Johnson. It's entitled Emotions, Thinking with Your Head and Acting with Your Heart. Doug, I get to call him Doug. Thank you so much for writing this book for us. What an undertaking.
Thank you, Michelle. A treat to be with you, and kudos on your many accomplishments as a psychologist and with the show. Oh. This feels like very friendly territory to me, and I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Well, thank you for saying that. It's a friendly thing. A lot of folks say, well, what are you going to be asking me, and how structured is it? This is a conversation. We have a good time. So you never know what's going to come out of my mind to ask you sometimes. And that's my emotion. Let's talk about you. And I really appreciate you being here again. I want to give folks a little bit about your bio. And I say about special guests like you that we could take half an hour, but let's just sort of compartmentalize what you've done. You're a former corporate executive, testifying expert, and I want to talk a little bit about that as well, and champion sailor. Now, we'll talk about that too, all right? You've had over a multi-decade career spanning banking, private equity, and litigation consulting. You developed a sustained interest in language, motivation, and emotional definition. So you've done it all. So you're here to grace us with your presence and talk about your latest book, Emotions, Thinking with Your Head and Acting with Your Heart. By the way, congratulations. Your book is ranked among the top 10 titles in 3 of Amazon's categories. Top 10. And those are positive psychology, emotions, and mental health, and also adult continuing education. So, but I know you can do it much better than I. So can you please describe your book for us?
Thank you for the big buildup, Michelle. That's marvelous. My background, to jump in, includes, as you noted, many years as a corporate executive in banking and finance. I helped to start one of the biggest companies in Los Angeles as one of the original 7 or 8 folks there. But over time, I morphed into becoming not only a corporate executive, but what's known as a testifying expert witness. So my familiarity with complex business transactions led major law firms to hire me as a professional researcher and testifying witness to help juries decide who was right or wrong in a specific matter. So 10 years ago, at that point, I was known to my daughter, my only child, as a professional researcher, and she was in 8th grade.
Aww.
And we came up with a game that instead of my giving her an allowance, which she fully expected at age 13, I decided I decided to make her earn it. And we came up with a game that we nicknamed College Bowl, which was that I would bring to a every 2 weeks, we would have a father-daughter dinner at a restaurant of her choice.
Love it.
I would bring a list of 150 or so questions about anything. Could be history, geography, math, science, art, music, politics, could be anything. And if she got the answer right to the question, I would I would slide a $2 bill across the table to her. And $2 just because it was unusual. And they knew me at the bank because I always cleaned them out of $2 bills. But so we started that, and it was wonderful. It was great for her because she's a good student. It was fun for me because as a parent, you don't always know what your 13-year-old is up to. And we could laugh. It was a wonderful time, father-daughter time.
Oh, I love that.
Well, it was a big hit, and I would recommend it to anyone. two years later, she's in 10th grade, now in high school, and she had been out of school for a month with an injury followed by an unrelated surgery. And as you would know, a month in 10th grade is a lifetime.
Yes.
So she arrives at dinner. Her face is sullen. She's normally very cheerful. And she said, Dad, may I ask the questions tonight? I said, sure. And she said, what do you know about depression? And Michelle, I faked it. I mean, I faked it that she was asking about finance. I said, oh, well, sweetheart, depression is a slowdown in economic activity accompanied by a decline in interest rates. And she shook her head and she said, no, Dad, not that.
Yeah, right.
You can appreciate that I was a deer in headlights. And I said, sweetheart, I have to admit, I don't know anything about emotional depression. And I can see from your face that that's something that's troubling you. I said, give me a few days. I'm going to do my research thing and I'll get into it. So away I go to Barnes & Noble, to online book vendors, to Amazon, to two laptops surrounded by books and articles. And I wasn't making a ton of progress understanding what it was like for her to experience this. About 3 days into it, I came across a quote from a 1950s writer by the name of Rollo May. I don't know if you know
his name. Classic.
Classic. He was one of the first self-help writers before anybody ever heard the term self-help.
Yep.
He had a PhD. He had a bachelor's in divinity, as I recall. And he was widely known in the 50s. And his quote, he was a depression survivor himself. His quote about depression was, depression is the inability to construct a future. And the moment I read that sentence, it was like it came alive to me. I understood what my daughter was facing. That was much more helpful than a standard dictionary definition of depression as an extended period of sadness, right? It was what it felt like.
Yes, and absolutely. Makes so much sense.
Well, so well, you know. And so a couple of days after that, I came across another quote from J.K. Rowling. I'm sure you know who she is, the author of the Harry Potter series.
Yes.
And her quote, she too had suffered from depression as a younger woman before she became a successful novelist. Her quote about depression is this: depression is that absence of being able to envision you will ever be cheerful again. It's the most unpleasant thing I've ever experienced. Well, that sort of added even more dimension.
Yes.
And then a day or two after that, a third quote from somebody who's not necessarily famous, but she's a brilliant freelance writer. Her name is Haley Cornell, and I want to give her credit because she moved the needle. Her quote, again, she too had suffered from depression. Her quote, depression lies. It tells you you've always felt this way and you always will, but you haven't and you won't.
Ah, love it.
Well, I mean, that's you would know. You have dealt with depression sufferers. And so here I am sitting at my desk surrounded by books and articles and laptops. And I thought, what the heck? It's 10 in the morning. My daughter's in class. I'm going to text those three quotes to her across town.
Oh, that's great. Yes.
And I did. And she shouldn't have been looking at her cell phone, but predictably perhaps she was. And so I texted them and pressed send. And 3 minutes later, I got a response. I'm crying, which alarmed me. And I wrote, sweetheart, why are you crying? All three of these people are survivors. There's hope. They got past it. And her response immediately was, "That's why I'm crying. Thank you, Dad."
Oh, I love that. What a great story. Oh, that was so cool.
But we were on to something, Michelle.
Yes, you were.
We were on to this notion that quotes from people who've experienced an emotion are often more helpful than what it looks like to a scientist from the outside.
Yes, absolutely. And it's their definition sort of how they see from their perspective, whatever the emotion is. In this case, it was depression. So, yeah.
Exactly. How it feels better than is often better than how it looks.
Yes.
So we were onto this. And so we morphed and expanded into anxiety and OCD and ultimately into a number of very happy emotions. But and blissfully, my daughter recovered and did well in high school and college. But we were onto an idea. And the idea was emotions as they're experienced by people who should know. So ultimately, it expanded to 272 different emotional states described by 8,000 quotes of 1,800 people across 2,500 years. That's a lot of numbers. But I say with a laugh, Michelle, if you don't mind, when I finished the book, The Last Emotional State, this was last summer, Last Emotional State, I sort of felt like Forrest Gump in the movie. I stopped running. I realized I'd done pretty much what I set out to do and published it. And in January, a friend was looking at an early copy and he said, "You ought to submit this to AI. And I instantly was a bit defensive. And I thought, no. None of these quotes are from AI. These are all human quotes.
Right.
And he said, no, that's not my point. His point was, why don't you submit your manuscript electronically to AI and see what it says? So imagine me with my finger poised. Do I send this or don't I?
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, the book is complete. I can't change it.
Right.
And I thought, you know what? I'm confident in the book. So I press send. And 3 minutes later, the response to the 130,000 word manuscript was, "This is the single most comprehensive reference book on emotions in the English language."
True.
And I paused. I thought, no, that can't be true. And so I tapped in, "Oh, please don't cheerlead. You know, I'm asking for your critique."
Right.
And the critique was, that is the critique. It's the most comprehensive ever in English. And I was perhaps like you, Michelle, I was shocked. Yeah. I was astounded. That wasn't what I was expecting. I was expecting, you know, page 322, you know, you had a typo there. I wasn't expecting that response.
Right, exactly.
And it was wonderful to get that sort of response. So somewhat by accident, this book covers 272 different emotional states. You would know this as a psychologist, when brilliant psychologists write about an emotion, they typically just pick one.
That's right.
I mean, that's just sort of the pattern.
It's true.
But this is the first time. Thank you. This is the first time they've all been together. And
love it. Amazing.
And that's sort of what we produced almost by accident. But it's been, as you indicated, it's been very well reviewed and very well regarded on Amazon. It's scoring really highly in top 10 categories. So it's been fun.
It has. Now, it took you, you say, 9 years in your bio, right? 9 years to write this.
I think we estimated 8,000 hours over 9 years, which means I'm a glutton for research, but that's what it was.
No, you and I, you know, you and I said to you jokingly before we went live, I said, "You have that stick-to-itiveness," and that's what my mom used to say, and your mom did too, right? And that's right.
My mother had a quote which actually made the book. There are 8,000 quotes. "When a job is first begun, never leave it till it's done.
Aww.
Be the labor great or small. Do it well or not at all."
Yes, I love that. That is so true.
We each have our mothers to thank for various things, and I certainly have my mother to thank for that.
Oh, that's so true. So, you know, people are going, "Whoa, this is an undertaking. Wow, should I get this book?" Yes, you should, guys, because it'll really help you define maybe your emotions in many different ways, which we can talk about, and the ways that amazing people from all walks of life define emotions from A to Z in the book. It is an emotionary, is that what you call it, Doug?
The nickname ascribed to it by a friend, which has stuck, is to call it an emotionary. So
yeah, I love it.
It is sort of in one A to Z alphabetical order. It combines elements of a dictionary, a thesaurus, an encyclopedia, and quotes all in one place. But it's
amazing.
Extremely easy to read. You can read it 5 minutes at a time or 2 hours at a time. If you have a specific emotion, you may be a content creator and are looking for what great thought leaders in the world had to say about excitement or enthusiasm or wonder or joy or any emotion. Patience could be curiosity. You'll find what some of the most insightful people in the world, and they range from the contributors. They range from somebody at the corner store to Nobel Prize winners. It isn't necessary to be a Nobel Prize winner to be quoted. It's important to have something insightful to add.
And
that was really the measure.
Thought leaders is the word, because I can't describe. I was reading through it, looking at just take depression, as a matter of fact, you know, the concept, how many people from all walks of life who are thought leaders who have described their own interpretation or how they would have felt. And it is based on their emotion for depression. So we're looking at Tupac, we're looking at Einstein, we're looking at religious leaders, philosophers, scientists who define their, anyone in the world who's who of a great thought leader and creative artist in any way. So thank you for that.
Beautifully said. So it crosses all genres. So it is absolutely apolitical. I think there's one quote from Donald Trump, one quote from Hillary Clinton, one quote from Barack Obama, but this is not a political text.
It's not.
It crosses all religions. I think there are at least 40 religions, all continents except Antarctica. It's astounding to me the number of brilliant quotes there are that are life-changing quotes that if you just simply do the research, as I did, can be really, really helpful. Virtually everyone on the planet, without exception, has suffered. And yet if you're at a stop or a pause in your life where you're suffering, what a relief to pick up a book and see what 25 of the world's greatest leaders across the arts and sciences have said about their time suffering and how they got through it.
It's
enormously helpful. Wouldn't you want to have that caliber of who's who team of supporters helping you get oriented? Yes, of course you would.
This is going to be my office coffee table book that I have to hide, that I have to hide every time I come in and leave the office because it's brilliant. So let's jump into this emotional thing, because I know a lot of people reached out and said, oh, this sounds amazing. And straighttalkdoc@gmail.com is the email you can use if you have any questions or comments for Doug. And we're talking about his book. So why, in your opinion, why do we struggle to try to explain or name what we're feeling? This happens so much of the time. You know,
I have, if I may, I'll start with a humorous response to that. One of the many people that I quoted in the book, obviously many psychologists among others, there's a psychologist who you probably know well, Harriet Lerner, and she has a humorous response about emotions, which probably resonates. Emotions are like children. You don't want them driving the car, but you can't stuff them in the trunk either.
True.
And I mean, that's a good belly laugh with that one. You know, the average person, nobody's average, everybody's unique, but the average person occasionally, you know, wonders, should I really be feeling this way? Or am I wrong to feel this way? Or they're reluctant to express the way they feel. To find that others before you have navigated that emotion is often extremely helpful, especially to you as a psychologist. I mean, you've got somebody on the couch or seat opposite you struggling. Either they're embarrassed to discuss their scene or don't actually have the words ready to address it. This book is a big bonus because it puts you right in the middle of other people who have a similar mind. You can look at a specific phrase and say, that's it. That's exactly the way I feel. And that was said by Einstein, or that was said by a great actor, or it was said by a great linguist or a philosopher or writer. It can be very helpful.
It really is. Again, the undertaking is just amazing. And really what I found that I really enjoyed from it was I'd find an emotion that I was curious about. And it has really helped me with patience as well. And I would start reading the different definitions that individuals, as you say, thought leaders, how they've defined a particular emotion. And I pick one of my favorites, but then there are two favorites. But then, so it's like a puzzle with each word, A to Z, as an emotion that you put together, and then it can help you form sort of an idea of, yes, that's how I'm feeling, and that's why I'm feeling. So that, I think that's the biggest mystery of so many people, that, you know, like, hence Freud, and how does that make you feel, and why do you suppose you feel that way? Get the book, folks, get this, you know.
Really there's a theme, Michelle, that emerged in my research. And again, 9 years ago, I didn't know where this was going to land. I certainly didn't know there were going to be 272. One of the themes that has emerged that I've quintuply checked across the various academic fields is the importance of words. We solve problems with words. And you may say, well, that sounds great, but if you're a nuclear physicist, you solve problems in equations and square root symbols and the like. Yes and no. Yeah. How about this quote from Niels Bohr, B-O-H-R, the Danish theoretical physicist. He was a colleague of Einstein. Niels Bohr won the Nobel Prize. And I'd like to read a quote from him about the importance of words.
Yep.
Here is Niels Bohr, Nobel Prize winner, theoretical physicist. His quote, what is it that we human beings ultimately depend upon? We depend upon our words. We are suspended in language.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, the story is told in words. And that's a simple thought. And yet, if you realize that, gosh, it really is words.
That's how we
explain things. That's how we resolve our problems. There is, you may be familiar with the Sloan Kettering Clinic.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely.
The cancer clinic in New York City, one of the tops in the world. Charles Kettering, you might think at a glance, would be a physician. Yeah, that's why it's the Sloan Kettering, but he's not. He was not even a graduate student. He was an undergraduate engineering student at Ohio State, and he ultimately migrated because of his brilliance to becoming the head of engineering for General Motors. So this guy was a problem solver, Charles Kettering.
Yeah, sure.
Here is his quote. And he, in the course of his career, owned 186 different patents. So we can say the guy can solve problems. Charles Kettering's quote, a problem well stated is a problem half solved.
Wow. Okay.
Well, that's a simple sentence, and yet it says
you
so
have
much.
To really think. Yes, it does. It sure does.
I'm going to give you another one.
Yeah.
Noam Chomsky, in his 90s, he's known as the father of modern linguistics. I think he taught at Harvard, and he's written countless books toward the end of his life at this moment. But his quote, language etches the grooves through which your thoughts must flow. Well, there are 13 different disciplines. I'm going to read just a couple more of them.
Sure, but please
they all point to the same thing.
Yeah.
Here is a quote from William Shakespeare out of Hamlet, suit the action to the word and the word to the action. It's about finding words to describe what's going on. And if you understand that that's the basic, I'm going to lead you to two more, if you don't mind.
Please.
One of them is from Dan Siegel.
Yeah,
you're probably familiar with him. He's a clinical psychiatrist at UCLA and a New York Times bestselling author. These are five words that I think should be cast in stone, attributable to Dan Siegel. And they are name it to tame it. In just five words,
he's
articulated the beauty of, if you've got a problem, if you're stuck somewhere, you can simply attach words to it, you are halfway home.
Oh, that is so true. What a beautifully said phrase. You have to think about that.
It's remarkable. Yeah, yeah. Just five words.
Yes. Yeah.
All right. And I give you one more for now.
Yep.
The other one for now is from Lisa Feldman Barrett. She is a clinical neuroscientist. That's a big word, a big term, at Northeast University in Boston. She is now, Lisa Feldman Barrett is now among the top 1% most often quoted scientists in the world. So if you haven't heard of her, okay, but she's widely known and respected in the scientific community. And her quote is, "The more finely grained your vocabulary, the more precisely your brain can construct emotion." It's all about words.
Wow. It is so all about words. It really is. And describing. And we all, I think, have our own description, you know, of the word. By the way, in case you just tuned in, I'm talking to D. Earl Johnston, otherwise known as Doug, and he's sharing his latest book. It's best-selling, and it's called Emotions, Thinking with Your Head and Acting with Your Heart. And we're going to get into heart-brain coherence, too, one of my favorite subjects, and I know you studied up on that one. But, you know, I was just thinking about, how difficult it is to really define a feeling, but this book lays it out, okay? In cognitive behavioral therapy, you know, one of the orientations that I work with, we teach people how to use their words. But it's difficult sometimes. It's like, how could you have said that better to your partner so they wouldn't take offense to it? How can you come from an I point of view rather than you are, right? All those fun little tricks that we work with. How can you change your thinking? This book helps you sort of change your thinking to define an emotion that you may be having that you're not sure of, and find the right one or the right ones, quotes from individuals that make you feel like you can vibe with or identify with. That's right. That's exactly how I'm feeling. So it helps you understand why. And that's what I love.
I'm going to add something to that thought. I'm not a psychologist. You are, but I think you'll identify this scene pretty readily. So you're the therapist, you're in the chair, and your patient is opposite you. And your question, of course, is, you know, what's troubling you? What's the issue?
What's going on?
And oftentimes a patient is either embarrassed to be there or thinks that emotions are for sissies or doesn't really have the words to describe what's troubling them because they think, well, gee, it's a couple things. It's not just one thing.
Yep.
But let's say that you ask the question and you say, well, what's troubling you? And the patient says, well, I'm anxious. That's it. I'm anxious all the time. I'm anxious.
Right.
That's it. I'm anxious. And so you as the therapist, well, okay. He says it's anxious, anxiety. That's, you know, there's a clinical path for that.
Sure. Right? Sure.
But what happens if the real problem isn't anxiety, it's addiction. And I don't mean drug addiction. It could be addiction to bubblegum. I mean, it could be anything.
Sure.
But what if the real problem isn't anxiety, which is what the patient says it is, the real problem is more addiction? Well, that's a very different path for you and for them.
That's right.
All right. But by using this book, you can simply say, well, why don't you read through anxiety and see if any of those 25 quotes from thought leaders matches what you're feeling?
Yes.
And they scan through and they go, well, that's it. That one, number that's, seven, that one
right.
there.
That's right. That's right.
And suddenly you can talk. Or they go, you know what? Maybe I should look at a couple other words. And so you flip over to addiction and you go, wait a minute. I thought it was anxiety, but that's it.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. No, it makes so much sense. Beautifully said. Yeah. People are just, what? And this can help them. So can we choose our emotions? And my answer to you would be yes, just because of what you defined in your book. We can sort of choose the explanation, the words that fit the kind of emotions that we're feeling. Okay. But go ahead.
I'm going to jump in because
I appreciate it.
You're asking wonderful questions. So, you know, what is an emotion? Sometimes you say, well, it gets the best of me. All right. I think at the end of the day, we can say that emotions really have, at a minimum, two primary functions. Number one of which is to protect you. Touch a hot stove and you withdraw your hand. Yes. If you hang around angry or aggressive people, you want to move away from them. Mm-hmm. So number one, it is to protect you. That's first and foremost. And that's the priority. You as a human being have an emotional system to protect you. All right. And so you react. Yes, of course you react. But your emotional system also has a second half, which is to help advance your life. So once you are protected, you can start to advance your life. And by that, I mean, you can be curious, you can be excited, you can express zeal or wonder or enthusiasm or love or curiosity.
Right.
So it's really both things. It is, number one, your emotional system protects you. Number two, it allows you to advance. And in that context, we can say that, yes, your emotions are a reaction, but they are also allowing you to choose what you do. And that's why I named the book Choosing Emotions, Thinking with Your Head and Acting with Your Heart, because when we're at our best, we are using our emotions to choose how to advance our lives, not simply react to them.
Oh, beautifully said. That is so nice. We just got an email. I just wanted to throw this out because it was coinciding with what I was going to ask you next. It's from Katie. And she says, are these all about negative emotions?
Yeah.
No.
not at all. No. It's a great question. It's 50-50. It's right down the middle between positive, uplifting ones like enthusiasm, excitement, zeal, wonder, on and on and on. Yeah. There are a great many happy, uplifting emotions.
Yes.
Love. Wait until you read about love. I mean,
I love that.
The number of insightful quotes about love that I'd never heard until I started to research them.
Right.
That can make you laugh out loud or make you feel euphoric. I mean that carefully. Euphoria, by the way, is one of the words that's included in the 272. A great many of them are, at least half, are uplifting. So there's a spectrum of emotions. I think we could say at the bottom would be death. You're not experiencing emotions when you're dead. On up to euphoria at a higher end. And all of them are included.
They are, beautifully said. And, you know, I hear so many people who say to me, how can I feel more happiness? You know, I say, well, what is happiness to you? What does that mean to you? And you just open the book, Doug, and you go, oh, look at all the definitions of how others perceive or have experienced their happiness. So I think this is the key here, is trying to understand, again, the positive, maybe more negative feelings or, you know, emotions that we're experiencing.
Well, your attention goes to negative things.
Why?
Because your emotional system properly has its first order of business to protect you.
That's right.
You prioritize negative information, but you don't have to always prioritize negative information. Once your bodily needs are covered, you can start to expand. And you say, well, gee, I'm bored, but you know, suddenly I'm curious and I'm interested in something new. And then you realize that you're choosing. You can wake up in the morning and say, today I'm going to investigate this.
And
you're choosing.
Yes.
So the word that I think that I may have been among the very first to add to the discussion is that emotions are navigational.
And
that's a simple word.
I like that.
But I think it works.
Yeah, it sure does. Yeah.
Emotions steer us away from bad stuff and they steer us toward good stuff. That's navigating.
Yes.
Michelle, if you think about it, if you think about emotions as navigational, I don't think you can go wrong. I mean, that's quite exactly what they do.
That's right. Is what can you learn from these feelings that you're having as well. And this book will, of course, by, you know, all of the definitions of it, really help you learn more about why, as we said, you know, perhaps. Well said. I was wondering, as an expert lexicon, how do you say it? You're a lexicon?
There's a funny story. My daughter's name is Lexi.
Oh, I love it.
And that is a pure coincidence. And I ended up being a lexicographer, which means
that's
somebody
right,
who
lexicographer.
Has to define words.
There you go.
Who would have ever thought that?
No, isn't that the well? It's the universe, the way the universe works. What can I tell you? Right? Exactly.
Yeah.
So what's the most misunderstood emotion that you think people are going through today?
Gosh, what a great question. I'm not sure I can speak for other people, but I can tell you what I sadly misunderstood. So a story about my mom, who I adored, but when I was 10 years old, my mother was the center of my universe. Unsurprisingly, she could do anything. She was a great athlete. She was a writer. She was an artist.
Aww.
She was a socialite.
Yeah.
She could chat with anybody about anything. And I turned to her one day in admiration of my mom. And I said, "Mom, how on earth do you do it all? I mean, you're always on the move.
Yeah.
You're always doing stuff." And she turned to me and she says, points at me, and she said, "It takes a big ego to succeed in this world." And you're laughing, and I'm now laughing. I shouldn't have, but my mother said it. I admired her. She was successful. I thought, well, I'm just accepting that in a whole cloth. It takes a big ego. So
right.
off I trot right. into the world with my mother encouraging me to have a big ego. All right,
sure.
Well, decades later, as I'm researching the book, I finally get to the word ego.
Yep.
And I was in for a really rude awakening. One of the great quotes in the book from Carl Jung, the founder of analytical psychology and a brilliant man. I'm sure you've read many of his works.
Yeah.
Carl Jung said this about ego. He said, "A man spends the first half of his life building up an ego and the second half of his life learning how important it is to dismantle it."
Wow. That is so true.
And I must have read that, Michelle. I must have read it 15 times.
Right, right.
It was 11 at night. I have my little trusty dog at my feet as I'm researching. And I buried my head in my hands. And I said out loud, "Oh, shh." Fill in
right.
the blank. I thought, I got a whole lot of explaining to
there,
do. I have been a miserable wretch of an egotist in my corporate life. And I thought, how can I fix this? I mean, I misunderstood.
Yes.
Well, fortunately, I kept reading that night, and I came across a quote from Eckhart Tolle, who I'm sure you've also heard
I love of. Eckhart Tolle. I love him.
And he has reached over 100 million people with his books and podcasts, so he's highly regarded. And his quote is, the wonderful thing about ego is that the minute you realize you've been using an ego, it vanishes because you can't fake yourself. An ego is something that sort of creeps into your life. It's a false front. It's a fake projection that you use to put other people at bay.
Sure, of course.
The minute you realize that that's what
yeah.
you've been doing, you're much less inclined to do it.
Yes.
So I drew comfort from Eckhart Tolle, at least encouraging me that, you know, the thing is spotting it. And the minute you spot it, it goes away. But an ego, it's a false front. It's not the real
sure.
you.
And that
really doesn't do justice to you or the people around you.
Right.
In the short run, it might give you an advantage. You know, I'm the boss, do it my way or the highway, or words like that.
Right.
And all too often I did that in my corporate life.
Well,
but hopefully I have learned not too late the importance of understanding that ego is not really a great thing.
Well, by you just saying that, I mean, you are humble. And to your point, though, about, you know, in our earlier days and discovering who we are growing up and, you know, we get to a certain age and then we reach, you know, a certain sort of level of understanding, we say, wow, why do I need that? Or because I think, you know, growing up and learning who we are, having an identity, finding ourselves through our particular choices of careers, that's part of our identity. We need to identify who we are growing up. And then when we get into it and we're a little older, we're more mature, we look back and I think say, wow, that was about my lack of self-confidence. all that stuff about I'm this and I'm that and I'm defining who I am. That's because I wasn't confident in just being who I am. I had to define myself through. And I think to a certain extent, that's good and normal. I don't mean to be contradictory, but I think getting in, to your point, getting into that realization that I don't kind of need this because people are more savvy too. And if you're in a group, the people can pick out the narcissists. There's the N word. I sell it.
Thank you for that. I love what you just said. And I had fun also researching narcissism, which is,
oh yes.
One of, I have so many favorites in the book. They're all my favorite children in the book, but, right. But the quotes about narcissism are really helpful to read, how to spot them, how to deal with them. And sadly, like for me, realizing that you are one or have been one, you know, that was a realization. The number of times, Michelle, that late at night, I would bury my head in my hands and go, my gosh, if I'd only understood that quote when I was 25 years old, I would have lived a very different life.
Right. But that's so true. But I think people who ask, am I a narcissist? Probably aren't.
Probably are not.
because they're no really self-awareness that they are. It's just kind of,
well, awareness is a very, very important emotional state.
Yes. Yes, it is.
It truly is.
Yeah. So, in your career, and I wanted to talk about this as well. You have been involved as an expert witness in over 50 cases, which is, I really am uncomfortable being on the stand as an expert witness. You know that because the opposite, you know, the other attorney defending whoever side you're on is going to nail you with your expertise, is going to try to make you, you know, out to be unintelligent and not worth what you're saying to defend the particular person you're defending. So words? Yes, go ahead.
That's extremely true. And so you've been on the stand, you've seen opposing counsel cross-examine you and try to undermine what you're saying and say, well, gee, right. I found in the course of my evolution as an expert witness that definitions became my friends.
Yes.
If I could cite from memory, and I have a fairly decent memory, if I could cite from memory on a witness stand in a open case in front of a jury, a definition for something, that would almost always help me win. I mean, I wasn't winning. I was simply explaining my position, but it would help me explain to the jury that my recommendation prevailed because the definition for that is this.
Yes.
And the opposing counsel really couldn't argue the point. And I'd say, so there we have it. The definitions provide shed the light on the answer.
That's right. And it's not about you and who you are and your expertise as well. It's about your knowledge and what you can share from others. Specific definitions that, that are looked at as fact.
They're very, very helpful. Here's a quote from Aristotle about, I'll give you a quote from Plato first about definitions. This is from Plato, 2,500 years ago. He who can properly define and divide is to be considered a god. Plato knows something about words. And then Aristotle, here's Aristotle's quote. It's the mark of an educated man or woman, we should say, to look for precision in each class of things so far as its nature permits. The great minds of history say the same thing. They say that it's about words and about defining words. And if you can define what you're feeling and thinking, you're going to live a happier life.
Well said. Boy, you sure are. Got another email from Adam here on straighttalkdoc@gmail.com, which fits perfectly into the next section. My wife always tells me that I'm too intellectual and cold. Is this normal for guys? And what's the value in emotions over being intellectual.
My gosh, I couldn't have asked for a better question. Please, please hug those people for me. I learned in my research that there are a couple of things that the average person misunderstands about emotions fundamentally. And, you know, there are probably a lot of things we each misunderstand about emotions, but these two hold pretty much across the board. First is this, again, there's no such thing as an average person. We are each unique, special in our own way, but collectively we can talk about averages. The average American, if you were to enter into the Google search bar, how many emotions does the average American think there are? Yes. That question.
Yes.
You would get the answer between 8 and 28.
Ooh, what? Right. Exactly.
And in many, on a different day, if you type that question into the Google search bar, it'll often tell you 6. Yes. And yet the book proves that they're in the low hundreds of emotions. And these aren't high-tech emotions. These are everyday emotions like, yes, like wonder and narcissism and bullying and flirtation and empathy and forgiveness and resentment and provocation and curiosity and zeal and joy. I mean, these aren't high-tech emotions. These are everyday emotions. So if you first understand that emotions are often in our culture downplayed, you know, the average strong man, yep, is told emotions are for sissies.
That's right. That's right.
You know, you're weak if you're emotional. My girlfriend, she's so emotional. Emotions get a bad rap.
Yes, they do.
But the science says, here I am acting like a scientist. I'm not, I'm a researcher. But 13 different academic disciplines all say at the highest Nobel level that emotions are not inferior to reason. They are foundational to reason.
Yes.
I'm going to say that again. Emotions are foundational to reason. You cannot reason. This is per, among others, Antonio Damasio, who teaches neuroscience at USC. He is on virtually anyone's list as one of the top 2 or 3 neuroscientists in the world. Widely, widely respected. He's won the Honda Prize, which is the equivalent of Nobel.
Wow.
His writings are extremely clear that emotions are prior to reason. You cannot reason unless you have emotions to assign value to your thoughts.
Oh,
that goes from Antonio Damasio to Daniel Kahneman, who is a psychologist and economist at Princeton, won the Nobel Prize. They all say the same thing, that emotions are foundational. And so if you understand that very subtle point,
yes,
that emotions get a bad name, but they're vital. They are foundational.
They really are.
To reason, if you get that, that's widely understood and unanimously agreed at the highest levels, it will change your life, because you will then realize that I should embrace emotions.
Yes.
The issue of, are there 6 emotions or 8 emotions or 28 emotions, we can readily dismiss, because I've easily documented they're in the low hundreds.
Yeah.
But imagine a friend of mine offered up this mental image picture, which is, he says, Doug, what you're saying is that, you know, whether we have 200 or 300 emotions, imagine sitting at a piano and there are not 88 keys, which is what a piano has. There are 300 keys or 272 keys. You can play a lot of music with 272 keys. He said, true, you can only play a very few set of songs if there are only 8 to 28 keys. And I thought, gosh, wow, what a beautiful image. If you want to play a nice symphony, you can learn some more notes. And you know, the simple truth is, the average person can remember 5,000 songs.
That's right.
I mean, it's not out of our realm at all. The average person, some people can track 10,000 songs. So it's not unheard of. It's that we just haven't elevated emotions as we should have.
Oh, beautifully said. Can you believe we're out of time?
Yeah.
This has gone so fast. Well, this is a joy to talk with you. What's the best way viewers and listeners can find out more about you, Doug?
Thank you. So choosing emotions, again, I picked the word choosing because when we're our best, we can choose emotions. Choosing emotions, thinking with your head and acting with your heart is the name of the book. The website is familiarly choosingemotions.com. You can buy the book at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Ingram Spark, countless places. It's available in hardback, in paperback, in Kindle, and it's doing blissfully very, very well.
Yes, it
in
is.
The ratings, and people enjoy it. It's very fun. There are laugh out loud moments
there
in
are.
Virtually every emotion, amazingly.
Right. And it's wonderful to laugh at ourselves. Like, oh my God, that's how I'm feeling too.
Well, so. One of the few quotes of my own that I added to the book, and I tested it before I added it, was, if you can laugh at an emotion, it does not control you.
Ooh, and, love it.
And I think that holds. So that
it
made
does.
The book.
Oh, beautifully said. Thank you again for being a wonderful guest. It's so nice to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me. I enjoyed every moment of it.
Great. Take good care now.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, everybody. Hopefully you got a lot out of that. And if you would like to know more, please pick up the book. It's brilliant. It will help you define your own emotions. And yeah, you'll learn a lot. And again, it's called Emotions, Thinking with Your Head and Acting with Your Heart. D. Earl Johnston is the author. Do take care of yourselves until I talk to you next week. And that's really not narcissistic. It's the way to take care of you, and then you'll be great for others. Thanks for joining me. Bye-bye.
You're listening to On the Couch with Dr. Michelle, right here on LA Talk Radio.